This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are going to take a look at the third film, sort of, even though he doesn't count it, by Quentin Tarantino, Four Rooms. But before we get into that, a little bit of news. Actually, it's a big piece of news. I mean, nothing which is shocking or anything like that, but it's a big piece of news. And, you know, it really goes a long way to this whole movie actually happening. And that's that they've hired a writer to write Star Trek 14, it's looking like now, Q-Trek, as I've been calling it. I think we need to get that to stick. But
I like that, Q-Trek.
Q-Trek. Mark L. Smith, who was one of the people who we talked about being in this writer's room, he is the writer of, well, a few things, but most notably The Revenant, which was directed by Alejandro González Iñárritu a few years back. It got nominated for a bunch of awards. And he also wrote a couple of other things, I guess most notably Vacancy, which a number of people seem to be fond of. But The Revenant, that's his big thing, you know, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and all that stuff. I mean, have you seen it?
I still haven't seen The Revenant. Yeah. Which is, I know, it's perpetually on my need to get around to it list. My wife has actually said she really wants me to see it because she wants to get my reaction to it, which is sort of a loaded statement. Because sometimes she's setting me up because she knows I'm going to come out of it like railing at it. But sometimes she does it because sometimes I really like something that she doesn't like and she likes to hear me, you know, pitch why we view it differently or something like that.
So she didn't like it.
She hasn't told me.
Oh.
She's held on to it for this long. She wants me to see it before she discusses it with me.
Now's your chance.
Yes. Now I have even more of a reason to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's a good enough reason to watch the movie. I mean, I personally, spoilers, am not very fond of it. I think it's kind of dumb. But I can definitely see why Tarantino would like it. I could totally see Tarantino liking it. Let's put it that way. It's a tale of revenge. It's, you know, kind of a Western in a weird way. It's extremely violent. It's also extremely visual, you know, which I think is interesting. You know, I mean, I think that's something, you know, one of the things that people have been talking about is like, you know, hey, this is kind of a weird mashup because like The Revenant is very, very sparse in terms of its dialogue. It's much more visual oriented and everything like that, whereas Tarantino is known for being rather verbose and everything. And I don't really see that. I mean, like, I remember, you know, back in 2004 when, you know, someone was interviewing Tarantino and asking him about, like, his favorite movies of the year or whatever. And he's like, oh, well, I think the best directed movie this year is The Passion of the Christ. You know, I mean, the fact that he did the whole thing and, you know, like a dead language and all this stuff. And, you know, it really sort of like speaks to the impact of the visuals of that thing. And, you know, it could almost be a silent movie. And, you know, if you look at it just on a purely visual level, it's the best directed movie of the year. And, you know, I mean, that's not at all surprising to me. But I see The Revenant sort of like falling into that same vein. You know what I mean?
I do. I do. Yeah. I mean, I see Tarantino. Yeah. I agree, is known for his dialogue. It's one of the things I love most about Tarantino movies that work for me. And I love his dialogue, but at the same time, it is very much in a comedy. Like, you mentioned silent movies. Let's look at, like, Star Wars. You can watch Star Wars as a silent movie because, you know, it's designed in that sort of way. But with Tarantino, I would say that, in a way, his dialogue is like the music of the film. And so his visuals are still really strong. It's just that the words are beautiful music that you listen to while the picture is playing. So I could completely see somebody writing a sparser sort of approach and then him coming in and saying, okay, well, I'm going to bring some more dialogue into it. Or maybe he wants to do something different. Maybe, you know, who knows? But it's not like Mark L. Smith is just going to hand a scene list to him and say, that's it. Now make pictures, you know?
But it also is, I mean, it sort of goes into that whole thing. I mean, they talk about, like, with Braveheart, you know, where, you know, the script was only like 90 pages or something like that, even though the movie was 3 hours. And, you know, you get to the big battle and it says, like, they fight, you know, and then that lasts for like a half an hour or whatever it is on screen, you know. And that, you know, if you think about it that way, you can also kind of see why it would appeal to Tarantino, because it's letting him make the movie his own. He's not just dictating, you know, or being dictated by what's on the page. He's actually getting to contribute, you know, to this movie in a meaningful way as a director. Maybe that's the challenge that he's giving himself, is, you know, to convey his ideas through visuals instead of through dialogue. But I mean, there's another thing which we can look at, which is kind of gives us some maybe idea into how this process will work, and that's the episode of CSI which he directed, Grave Danger, which is the season 5 finale. So extra credit homework for anyone who wants to be an overachiever here. Go check out Grave Danger. You can get it on iTunes for $3. I know this because I just did. And it's a double length episode. I mean, this is one of the things that they talked about. Like, it was supposed to be just an hour long episode, you know, your standard CSI, but when Tarantino directed it, even though the script was only 45 pages, like, Tarantino's pacing in terms of scenes and everything like that is much more drawn out. And those 45 pages ended up doubling in terms of length of scenes and stuff like that, because he was really letting things play out visually and that sort of thing. And when they looked at the cut, they were like, wow, this is way too long. And then they were like, you know what? We could just make this a 2-hour long episode instead of, you know, trying to cut everything down. And that's what they did. But, you know, one of the things which really stood out to me in that regard is that this was a story by Tarantino that he did not write himself. He came up with the story. He worked on it with the writing staff. And then the writers, the showrunner at the time was a Star Trek veteran, by the way, Naren Shankar, you know, who worked, he was originally the science advisor on Next Generation, then he worked on Next Gen and a few other shows, and then eventually became the showrunner on CSI, and now he does like The Expanse and stuff like that. But he, you know, wrote that episode of CSI, and, you know, after he wrote it, you know, Tarantino did like a little pass in terms of the dialogue and everything. And there are a number of scenes in that episode where you're like, this feels like Tarantino wrote it. The fact that they're having this conversation, but also the way that the dialogue plays and everything like that, like, this really does feel like a Tarantino script. And I could totally see, I mean, since the process here is almost exactly the same, you know, at least on the surface, it seems, I can totally see, you know, Tarantino doing a pass and, you know, this script, which is written by Smith, coming out feeling like a Tarantino script, especially since he came up with the idea for the story himself initially, you know?
Yeah. I, you know, it's, I don't know. It's still so weird to think that Tarantino's doing this. Like, it's so bizarre. I don't know what reality I'm living in. And what's funny is even with Smith's hiring, people are still doubting this is going to happen. And it's like, this is pretty far along in a process here. I mean, at the same time, I feel really bad for Payne and McKay. Because It was originally, oh, well, no, we're going to make their script for the fourth one. And then Tarantino's like, I'd like to make it. Sorry, guys. You know, like, I feel bad for them. Really, really bad for them.
I feel bad for them, too. Luckily, they do have some stuff which is, I think, actually in production right now. Most notably, the Jungle Cruise movie with The Rock. That was written by them. And I believe that's actually being shot right now, so that's pretty cool. So good for them in that regard. So Smith came out of that writer's room, and you know, a few names were tossed out as to who was in the room, but another name was revealed when Smith got the job. I guess someone who didn't get the job, but whatever, someone who was there certainly helping break this story was a woman named Megan Amram, who...
Yeah, I think that's how you pronounce the last name, yeah.
Yeah, I had never heard of her, although, you know, after, you know, looking her up, I'm like, oh, yeah, I do see her being retweeted all the freaking time on Twitter. But she is a television writer primarily, I guess most noteworthy. She worked on Parks and Recreation, and she's done a number of other things, one of which is still on the air right now. But when I mentioned it to you, you're like, oh, yeah, she's awesome.
She is. She's really funny. She is legit really funny. There's a reason you see her being retweeted all the time, is because she says funny things all the time. Like, she is a legitimate LOL when I see stuff from her. Like, she is on point. And the idea that she's in the room, I think also one of the things that has people a little bit tense is whether Tarantino is going to be super serious and therefore it's going to be a real big tonal thing for Star Trek to turn that serious. If they have somebody who's known for writing comedy in the room, at least, like, I think that's a big reassuring sign that they're going to bring the laughs that we're all accustomed to. Like, Star Trek 2 has laughs, Star Trek 6 has laughs, 4 is all laughs. You have laughs in First Contact. So there, you know, like, this isn't going to be a funeral dirge movie. There's going to be humor in here. And I think that Amram being there, you know, speaks to that.
I have to say, I don't think I was ever worried about that. I mean, I to some degree or another, I think you could consider every single Tarantino movie to be a comedy, you know?
Well, there's a difference here, though, okay, because you have sort of a sliding scale of Tarantino's, you know, laugh-o-meter, as it were, where, you know, the movie we're going to be talking about, Four Rooms, the story he does in that very much is, that's higher on the Tarantino silly meter. I'll call it the silly meter.
Yeah.
Hateful Eight would be really low on that meter, be it about a 0.1, maybe.
Okay.
That's a really intense film. There's some laughs in it. There's some chuckles, but they're uncomfortable. And, you know, like, it, I think it's an indication it's not going to be down with Hateful Eight in terms of the humor. It's going to be higher up on the scale than that. I think that should be reassuring to people.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. All right. Well, speaking of Four Rooms and speaking of something high on Tarantino's silly meter, should we talk about this week's movie?
Let's talk about this week's movie, Mike.
Let's talk about it. Four Rooms. Now, this is an oddball thing in, you know, like we were saying, Tarantino doesn't count it as one of his 10, just like he's probably not going to count Star Trek as one of his 10. And the reason for it is because he only directed a quarter of the movie, because as the title suggests, this is a story about four rooms, and each room is directed by a different filmmaker. Those filmmakers are Alison Anders, Alexander Rockwell, Robert Rodriguez, and Quentin Tarantino, four names who were fairly large to huge in the indie film world in the mid-90s when this movie was released, December 25th, 1995. And, yeah, it's one of those good old-fashioned anthology movies. So do you want to give us a synopsis of Four Rooms?
Sure. Tim Roth, Ted the Bellhop, it's his first night, happens to be New Year's Eve, and he has to go through and tend to the needs of these four rooms, and wackiness ensues, because in one room is a coven of witches with Madonna. In one room is a guy who was on Goodfellas having a very stressful time with his bound wife. You have Robert Rodriguez calling in Antonio Banderas to be in a Robert Rodriguez thing, and children of his as well. And you have Quentin Tarantino being Quentin Tarantino in one of those rooms. And Tim Roth is the connective tissue through it all.
Yeah. This is a movie which... It came out, like we were saying, December 25th, 1995. So this would have been like right before I saw Pulp Fiction, right? But you had already seen both Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. And the buzz coming out of it was less than great.
That is true.
So if this had come out literally a year later, I would have been there on opening day. Probably not opening day, because my mom would have never let me go see a movie on Christmas, but, you know, whatever. But I would have been there the day after opening day, and I would just be all in to the fact that a new movie co-directed by Quentin Tarantino was coming out. Nothing could have kept me from this theater aside from my mom on Christmas. But for you, someone who did not have, you know, my mom as a barrier, and who had seen Tarantino and knew what he was capable of, why didn't you see this movie back in 1995?
Bad reviews.
Really?
Bad reviews kept me. Yeah, there were enough bad reviews, and gosh, by this point, yes, I was seeing movies on Christmas Day with my pal Joey. It started with my brother. We used to go to movies on Christmas Day. And then my brother, you know, grew up a little bit, got engaged, and was dead to me for a couple of years. But Joey stepped in, and we would see a Christmas movie, and this just never, either it wasn't playing near, like, if it was wide release, it just wasn't at a convenient time for us. But I think also just the bad reviews, especially the reviews really hammered. I remember the tone of the reviews being two of the stories in this aren't worth watching and the other two are fun, but save your time and money was the tone of the reviews that I got. And so that's enough to keep me out. I'm trying to remember now what else came out on Christmas Day in 1995, because I know I saw something. I've got to go now and figure out what was out that day to figure it out, because I'm hoping it wasn't Dracula Dead and Loving It, because I think that's right around that time period, and that movie is atrocious. We tried to get our money back for that one, but they wouldn't give it to us, so we finished the film.
Dracula Dead and Loving It was out. Yes, it did come out that
That's
day.
The one I saw, okay. And I bet wrong. I can tell you, we're about to go into our discussion of Four Rooms. We bet wrong.
Okay.
We really bet wrong, because Dracula Dead and Loving It is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life.
I mean, you had a lot of choices. Waiting to Exhale, Grumpier Old Men, Sudden Death, Tom and Huck, Nixon, Cutthroat Island, Balto. Yeah.
And we wound up with Dracula Dead and Loving It because we were Mel Brooks fans.
Okay.
And Leslie Nielsen fans. So there you go.
All right. Well, I didn't see any of those movies. I do remember Christmas Day 1995, because I remember my cousin, who is much older than me, saying like, oh, you know, you're interested in film, and me being, you know, a 15-year-old kid who knew everything about movies, even though I had never seen a Quentin Tarantino film, was like, yeah. And he's like, well, how about Four Rooms? And I was like, no, I'm not into Tarantino. By being not into Tarantino, I mean never having seen Tarantino, but whatever, you know. But I, you know, the reviews kept me away too, because I had not quite reached that point where I was like, you know, Tarantino's involved. I have to see all of his movies as soon as they come out. That would happen like a year later, like just with filmmakers in general, you know. There was still like this sort of like weird thing where I'd be like, I don't know. I don't really know if I want to see that new George Lucas movie. You know, I don't know if I want to see that new Spielberg movie. Whereas, you know, like now it's like Spielberg's got a new movie coming out. What's it about? Who cares? We're watching it, obviously. You know, I mean, what are you talking about? So, and
for I don't know if that's necessarily true with Spielberg anymore, but hey.
Okay, all right. Well, Four Rooms has two of those people for me. It has, you know, Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah.
But, you know, the reviews kept me away, you know, peer pressure kept me away. And it wasn't until I got the Laserdisc for Pulp Fiction, which was, by the way, on Holy Thursday, 1996. Remember it well. And,
and how appropriate.
It makes sense in a lot of ways. But on that disc, in addition to having like a ton of like international trailers for Pulp Fiction at the very end, I think more as a promotional item than anything else, go figure, they had a trailer for Four Rooms. And I watched that trailer a million times because like when I was in high school, you know, having a Laserdisc player and with these things being widescreen and with my tastes being sort of this very weird kind of like scattershot, like it wasn't like I just liked the big movies or like I liked all of the small movies. It was just like I had seen random things here and there. It was completely all over the place. So it's like, oh, yeah, Living in Oblivion is one of my favorite movies, even though no one else has seen it. But then someone would be like, what do you think about Schindler's List? And I'd be like, I haven't seen that. You know, what are you talking about? I mean, it was completely all over the place. But because of that, there were like a lot of movies which I loved, which no one else had even like heard of, right? So you'd like talk to people at school about it and everything like that. And back in the day, like the way that I had a Laserdisc player and I had a VHS player recorder, right? And I would make mixtapes for people, but instead of them being like songs, they would be movies. You know, it's 6 hours on a tape. I would put like, you know, three movies together.
You and my friend Joey would have gotten along very, very well, because there's a difference between SPLP and SLP. And he would give me an SLP tape. He would do the same thing. He'd be like, yeah, hey, here's three movies you should see.
Right. And I wouldn't just like stick three movies on the tape and then call it a day. I would do things like I would put trailers before each movie, you know, that sort of thing, right?
You were Grindhouse before Tarantino was.
Yeah, that's you know, that was fun. That's like what I did during high school instead of homework, you know? So, you know, with the Four Rooms trailer there, because I only had whatever trailers were on the Laserdiscs. I mean, like I was limited in my collection, you know, I would put these different things in. And so the Four Rooms trailer I saw a million times. I mean, any trailer that was on any Laserdisc I saw a million times. And, you know, that Four Rooms trailer was certainly one of them. And, you know, after watching it, you know, about a million times, I was like, I should, you know, check out this movie, even though everyone says it's bad. I mean, it looked funny and everything like that. And when Video Magic was closing, you know, they were selling the tape for like $4, and I bought it. And I don't even know why I did this. Maybe it was because of those terrible reviews or whatever, but I essentially fast-forwarded through the first two, you know, shorts and went to the Rodriguez and the Tarantino shorts. And I was like, these are great. You know, those other, I eventually watched them, but I think I was like, those other ones are garbage, but these two are great. And, you know, I watched those again and again and again. And then when Blockbuster Music, which was a thing, was going out of business, they put all of their Laserdiscs on sale for $10, which is insane, you know. And it was really like, oh my God. Well, any movie which I think is even halfway decent, I need to buy it because it's $10. Why wouldn't you buy it? That's the cheapest you'll ever find a Laserdisc for. And, you know, they had four rooms, so I bought it. And that's when I started, you know, watching it, you know, more intently. And I like it quite a bit. I mean, what do you think about it? You just saw it now. What do you think about it?
I think that were I to watch this again, I would do what you did the first time and fast forward through the first two vignettes. The movie comes alive when Rodriguez's story starts, Misbehave. It has such a sense of fun. Guillermo Navarro is doing the cinematography.
Star Trek Discovery is Guillermo Navarro.
And it comes alive, and it's funny, and it's like I actually started laughing. I was like, oh, okay, all right, yeah, yes, this is Robert Rodriguez. I am not surprised that I'm responding well to this. And then it goes into Tarantino's story, and I'm like, it is so classic Tarantino love affair with the old, you know, swinging Vegas 60s vibe thing that I plug into it, and I love it. And it's, and you know what? And I love that it's Tarantino being himself through the whole thing. And you got Bruce Willis there, and who was actually, he was almost sued by the Screen Actors Guild because he appeared in it for free. He waived his fee as a favor to Tarantino.
Yeah, he's not credited or anything.
Right. And the Screen Actors Guild actually had a problem with it, apparently. And I forget how they arbitrated out of it. But anyway, like, so if you had sat me down and said, just watch these two, I'd have been perfectly happy. I wouldn't have even noticed the other two weren't there, because the Coven one is there. There's some funny stuff in it, but it's fleeting. It's very fleeting. The second one with the wife tied up and everything is just bizarre. It just doesn't, like, none of the jokes land, none of the beats land. But then again, you get to Rodriguez, you get to Tarantino, and it's them, and they're young and they're fresh and they're on fire, and it comes across. So that's my impression of it. So,
yeah, for me, I mean, like, you look at the first two and they're not nearly as good as the others, but, like, you know, the first one, which was the Alice and Anders episode, which was about the coven of witches, like, I still find that to be really funny and offbeat and sort of, you know, weird and cool. And I think the performances are really good. You know, they've got like a really good cast, like Ione Sky is in it and stuff, and Madonna is pretty cool and everything. And it's just weird enough to be cool. Like the second one, you know, I mean, that also sort of grows on me, where it's, you know, this weird thing with like Jennifer Beals and stuff. And I don't know, like as it sort of ramps up, you know, like I do think that it is amusing and entertaining. Like both of those are episodes where if they were just on their own, I'd be like, oh, whatever, that's fun, that's cool. And, you know, I'd move on with my life. But you're right. Like when it gets to the Rodriguez segment, the Misbehaviors, I mean, that's pretty great, you know, and it really is full on Rodriguez. Like, you know, you're saying Guillermo Navarro shot it, and, you know, he shot the pilot for Discovery, like we were saying, and the photography is just absolutely gorgeous. You know, Banderas is in it. He's hilarious. The kids are funny and everything. And it's actually that short, as insignificant as this movie is or whatever, but that short was the inspiration for Spy Kids.
I can see that. I can clearly see that.
Which is kind of hilarious that, you know, yeah, it's like his kids movie came from this, you know, R-rated, you know, movie. But, you know, it makes sense. He's like, oh, you know, seeing Banderas with those kids, that's, you know, it was just, you know.
And you know what? I know I'm interjecting here, but like, the thing I love about Banderas working with Rodriguez is I think that Rodriguez gets something special out of him. I think he gets an energy out of him that is fun. Like you can tell that Banderas, like you look at some of his other performances, you're like, but whenever he's paired up with Rodriguez, he is on point and on fire. There is some language that they, you know, some film director to actor sort of vibe that they both plug into that is really magical. I think is just great, and I think it comes across there. Sorry to interject, but I just wanted to heap more praise on Banderas.
Yeah, no, he's really good. He's really good. And so is Tim Roth, you know, and everything in all of these, I think. And it's weird to see how his performance kind of changes with the directors and everything. And his performance in general is just so bizarre. It's just so out there. Like, he's doing some really, really weird things throughout this entire movie.
That is true.
But, yeah, when you get to the Tarantino sequence and immediately, you know, you get into this big, long Steadicam shot, you know, which goes on for like 10 minutes. And, you know, it takes you around the room and there's this whole thing, which is based on an old Alfred Hitchcock episode and all this stuff. And it's really, really awesome. I mean, I think that this stands up there with, you know, any of Tarantino's other movies. You know, it's pretty great. And it really is worth the price of admission. It's worth, you know, going, you know, watching another hour of stuff that, you know, you may not particularly like just to get to this. And I don't know. I love it. I love it so much. I really, really do. And yeah. I get the impression that Tarantino doesn't like it that much. Like, this is one of those things, and, you know, maybe reason for concern that he won't do a Star Trek movie, you know, after all this, you know, talk or whatever. But, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, the idea was pitched or whatever. And, you know, everyone's like, this is great. Let's do this, you know, and everyone was on board. And then Tarantino was kind of like, I don't really want to do this anymore. And everyone else was like, whoa, you know, we're names, quote unquote, you know, but like, no one is going to fund this movie if we don't have you, if we don't have Tarantino, right? And the other three filmmakers really had to talk Tarantino into doing the movie in order to get the movie made. And once he agreed to do it, you know, I don't know. I get the impression that the only reason why he agreed to do it was because he felt an obligation to his fellow filmmakers, you know?
Well, if this is the type of effort he puts in when he just simply feels obligated to do something, I think that is a sterling recommendation for just the raw talent that he possesses. Because there are, you know, one of the guys that I talk about a lot is Ridley Scott, whose production is, you know, through the roof. You know, he's like 1,000 movies a year coming out. And he has this ebb and flow. But you go to his movies because it might suck or it might be a masterpiece. It, you know, goes back and forth. I think we've talked about this ourselves. And with Tarantino, even his downbeat here, he's, you know, he's stepping up to the plate and he's delivering. You know, like for somebody not to really care for what they're doing, he still showed up to work and he still got it done. And that is, I think, really, really speaks well of him and his talent.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. Oh, well. So, a minor work in Tarantino's filmography, but, you know, mm-hmm. and a shorter work. But if you're looking for some more Tarantino in this time period or whatever, if on this journey you want to make sure you hit every Tarantino thing there is to hit, I guess I would also recommend watching his episode of ER, which is from season one. It's called Motherhood. And again, I don't mean to sound like a salesman here, but you can get it on iTunes for 99 cents. I know, because I just did. So definitely check that out, especially, you know, seeing him work within the confines of a franchise or, you know, a television show, see what he brings to it. And that's a case where he didn't even write the script. It was just like, this is what falls on his whatever. And it's really, really awesome. And yeah, I highly recommend that as well. So, all right. Well, and any final thoughts on Four Rooms?
If you rent it, you will just be fine watching the last two. But if you watch the whole thing, it's an hour and 37 minutes. So it's it's over and done pretty quick. And, you know, honestly, I mentioned Dracula Dead and loving it. And of the two movies I could have seen on December 25th, 1995, I picked the wrong one. So we'll leave it at that.
There you go. There you go. I definitely recommend it. It's not on Netflix or anything, but you can get it on like Amazon and iTunes and all that good stuff. You know, you can rent it there, or it's only like $8 to buy. So, you know, why not? And yeah, just one other Star Trek connection, just because, you know, the assistant director on the first and third segments is Douglas Ernie Okoski, who directed an episode of Discovery this year. So, hey, you know,
there you
go. That's pretty cool. Yeah. So check it out. Check out Four Rooms. At least that's what I say. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Four Rooms today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
I actually hadn't watched the show, I'm embarrassed to say, but I sat down and I started watching and recording episodes, and I immediately had an idea for a script because I found Data to be the most interesting character.
To the journey!
So you could have, like, you know, carbonated gog.
Carbonated gog? I'm trying to understand how this works. So the gawk are presumably a little squishy or juicy on the inside. So you're saying that in order to give them the appearance of life, they replicate it with carbonation inside the gawk.
Yes, to make them like pop and fizz. Kind of like an Alka-Seltzer, you know?
Like pop fizz fizz. Candy gawk.
Warp 5.
And I go into the job interview, and I'm just parroting back to him things he said in his interviews. But he didn't know that I was just doing that. I would say, the thing about Star Trek is that you could write it's a mystery one week, and it's a Western the next week, and I'm literally word for word things he said in an interview. So that's how I always feel, and I joke with him now that that's how I got the job. But
the 602 Club.
When we're talking about the idea of context in history, I think this is the biggest issue that I see in this film, and with the Force Awakens too. And you put them together because they're going to make a trilogy. Is look. Writing 101, if you don't know the past and the future of your characters, you absolutely 100% cannot write their present.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV. Or on the desktop iTunes app and get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place is to join the larger conversation in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just pick choose to send to a show and select Stage 9. That'll come right to us, and you can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, gosh, you can find me as Kessel Junkie. You can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And if you go over to the Nerd Party, you can go ahead and find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing and Great Shot Kid with you.
Yeah, you can find me over there doing Great Shot Kid, and you can also find me on my website, commentarytrackstars.com, doing a show called Commentary Track Stars, and you can find me right here on Trek FM doing a show called The Edge, and you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Chris, I'm totally coming to the LBJ library as soon as I get to Austin, Texas. That's
how could you not?
Yeah, I know, right? Anyway, If you'd like to be like Chris, Jeff, and Norm, you can help us out by becoming a patron of the network on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce and host and distribute all these shows each month, and we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. All right. Well, you know what? We only talked about a quarter of a movie today, but we're going to start ramping that up slowly. Next week, we're going to talk about a nice, long, awesome movie, which just celebrated its 20th anniversary. Pam Grier is
Jackie Brown.